Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, listeners, to the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm your host, Julian Klimochko. I'm joined by my co-host, Mike Kesslering. And on today's podcast, we welcome special guest, Ajay Kochhar, CEO and co-founder at Li-Cycle, North America's largest lithium-ion battery resource recycling company. Li-Cycle recently announced a merger with SPAC Peridot Acquisition at a $1.1 billion enterprise value. On today's podcast, Ajay discusses how he co-founded the company and grew the business to where it is today, Li-Cycle's technological advantage and high recovery rates, the background behind Li-Cycle's merger with SPAC Peridot Acquisition, his advice for entrepreneurs and CEOs considering merging with a SPAC, key growth initiatives at Li-Cycle, why investors should consider Li-Cycle stock, and more. So with no further ado, here's our discussion with Ajay Kochhar. Welcome, Ajay, to the Absolute Return podcast. Exciting times going on at Li-Cycle. Recently announced going public transaction, well received by the market. Great valuation you guys got, north of $1 billion. And accompanying that was a sizable financing, $315 million PIPE financing, along with cash in the SPAC, giving you guys access to tremendous amount of capital. So we're excited to get into where you see growth opportunities, organic, inorganic, M&A, and things of that nature. But prior to getting to all the technical details, let's start really at the beginning. You launched Li-Cycle, North America's largest lithium-ion battery resource recycling company in 2016, so less than 5 years ago. How did you come up with the idea for the business? And what in your prior experience helped you start the company? Like, was it a sudden light bulb moment where you discovered, wow, this is a great idea. We really need to pursue this full time.
Yeah, and great to be here, Julian. Thanks for having me on. So yeah, let's start at the beginning. You know, we founded this company, as you said, 2016. I'm a chemical engineer by background. Tim Johnson, my co-founder, also an engineer. So we used to work at a firm named Hatch, which is a global engineering, procurement, construction management firm. And we were really focused on two areas. One was battery materials. So lithium, nickel, cobalt that go into cathodes and into cells and then into the products that we use. And also project execution and building plants that are metallurgical, wet chemistry in nature that make these materials that we use in our everyday lives. So we're doing that for a long time. The lithium ion battery demand drivers changed drastically during that time and continue to change to the upside from burgeoning growth. And we saw recycling, you know, as engineers, advisors in the space, as a glaring hole. We didn't see a solution that was sustainable, meaning both economically sustainable and environmentally sustainable to deal with the recycling of all types of lithium-ion batteries. So we set out to change that. And again, that was late 2016. You know, the high level points there, and we'll dive into this more, but just the initial seed of inception, and I'll just dig a little deeper because it is important to the story. What was frustrating us was that when we were looking at the space and we were working lithium heavily, you know, we'd get asked about recycling. And when we looked into it, we found out that a lot of these batteries have been going to thermal processing. So where a lot of materials are burned off and groups target maybe cobalt, you know, a small portion of the mass. But lithium, for example, is lost and you lose a lot of the other materials. And so we were looking at that, scratching our head saying, how can that be? Like this is a inherently net environmental benefit industry. So we can't be using, you know, resources like hydrocarbons where they can't be recycled and used again because they can. And we have to find a better way that actually unlocks that value. And so that's what led to our development, you know, the whole path of Manon, which I'll get into. But that was really the seed of inception initially when we started the business.
And as the business developed over the past, call it 5 years, what were some key milestones achieved prior to the announcement of this going public transaction? Because, you know, in contrast to say like a software business where they can start with a concept and start gaining traction with a minimum viable product, for a large CapEx intensive, you know, asset such as a lithium ion battery recycling facility, you know, what point in time did you really see the business model progress and become, you know, quote unquote, like a real company in terms of startup lingo?
Yeah, and maybe I can first then level set a little bit on what we do, because it links to how we've scaled and then why we're, you know, doing this transaction and what we achieved before this. So we run a two-stage model. It's a spoken hub model. Simple terms, why do we do that? The whole point is get the spoke facilities, the mechanical processing that we do, close to where batteries are. So where are batteries? They follow population centers, EV penetration, battery manufacturing. And again, back to what was happening before we came along, you had all batteries typically being consolidated in one place in the world at a smelter. And when we were working with our customers, this is a big pain point, right? They don't want to be shipping batteries from Brazil to Europe. I mean, it doesn't make any sense long term. So we kept our ear to ground, you know, brought customers along what we were doing. And that was where we basically divided up the spoke part of what we're doing. Low capex plants, we have two of those plants operating today. The second part of what we do is the hub. So we generate these intermediate products regionally close to where batteries are, get it from being a battery into a product, so isolate out the physical materials, and that's more easily transportable to then the hub, which is centralized, which is where we remake that lithium, nickel, cobalt, and more, those chemicals. So that's the model that we've espoused. It's both the business model flow and the technology. Both steps are patented. So back to your question of what did we do before this transaction, two things. I'll split it into two camps. You know, and this is typical, you know, business, you know, when you're also building something real, it's iterative, right? So we had set out initially the full chain. We had both technologies. Probably about 2018, 19, we actually split them apart because we were hearing this from the customers. We were seeing this happening around logistics. So we said, why are we doing all this at once? Let's just start with something that's more manageable, scalable, lower cost, which is the spoke. So we built our first one. It was up and running last year commercially. We've now built a second one. So what that enabled us to do is we have now 40 plus battery supply customers. Already now we've been in the market, as you said, the largest battery cycle in North America. But what that means is we have an install base. We have the batteries that are filling those facilities. We're making product and returning that product back to the market. And that enabled us to start generating revenue. That intermediate product I mentioned, we can sell it, you know, on an interim basis. So that was really critical. I say as one camp of development, that's really important. And now that part of our business is really copy-paste mode. We have a plan for 18 more of those around the world. The second part, the hub, alongside that, what that enabled us to do was take the time to do, as you say, the physical validation work that we needed to do. And that is everything through a large-scale demo, which we ran for a year, spent over $10 million on that. But before that, we did pilot and mini pilot and lab scale work and say, this is hard tech. This is not soft tech. So you got to do it. It takes time. And we ran that, collected the design criteria, the data we need, made the products, those battery grade chemicals to go back into batteries. And that's what's given us the predication now to move into execution of that large hub plant. And that's why we raised this round, or that's why we went through this transaction to basically fully fund the business on that path. I'll pause there. A lot of information, but that ties together both the technology and what we've done before this.
And now a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest growing alternative investment solution providers, with a suite of institutional caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund, symbol ARB on the TSX, is the world's first SPAC-focused ETF with a diversified portfolio of SPAC and merger arbitrage opportunities in an easy-to-use, low-cost ETF. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund ETF trades under the symbol ARB on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
And so it's really sticking on the technology side with your spoken hub model. You're able to achieve some pretty exceptional results in terms of your recovery rate at over 95%. Can you just discuss how that's possible with your technologies? And is it, from what I'm hearing, is it a matter of being the largest in the space and kind of some of the benefits to scale? Or what's attributing to those high recovery rates?
Yeah, it's more actually the fundamental of what we're doing, which drives that. Yeah, so I'm going to explain this in, again, two parts. I'll talk about why were the recovery rates so low before us, and then what are we doing? So it does come back to what I was opening with on the thermal side. So when you treat a battery thermally, what's in a battery, right? You have graphite on the anode side, you have on the cathode side, you have a material that's the formulation of lithium, nickel, cobalt, typically, or different materials. You have metals, you have plastic, you have electrolyte. So that's what's in these batteries that we carry around, same in the EV. Now, when you throw that into a furnace or you do some other pre-processing, and then eventually throw that material into a furnace, a thermal process. The graphite is lost. So that's a big chunk of the mass of the battery. The electrolyte gets burned off, another big chunk of the mass. You lose the lithium to a waste stream. You're really left with part of the cobalt, copper, and nickel. So that, just from a mass perspective, and this is actually what is regulated around the world when there's battery recycling regulation, you start chipping away, you end up being below 50% pretty easily in what you've recovered. So what we did, the Spoken Hub model, back to your question, it's non-thermal. So at no point are we burning off anything. It's, you know, close to room temperature. And the spoke, I'll say they're the key driver of the high recovery. What we have to figure out is how to get this isolated cathode anode material from the battery, which is where the value is. And there's a lot of know-how and IP there. And then on the hub side, same thing, you know, work through the demo, de-risk, run an integrated large plant for demo size. And there, I'd say the challenge really has been, and we've overcome it now, you know, no material in geology has lithium, nickel, cobalt, all these things together, right? So you can use the same toolkit of metallurgy, but it's never been done this way before. So we've leveraged, you know, known equipment, known processes that are known to scale, but applied them in a novel and inventive fashion. And there's some difficulty there on how you recover lithium and, you know, keep recoveries high and costs low and minimize losses. So we've worked through all that. But yeah, that's how we are today, you know, where we are today, where we got to, but took some time and a lot of iteration.
So Ajay, I watched a number of the presentations that you did, and you're asked, you know, what sort of battery types do you take? And you indicated that Li-Cycle is able to recycle and take a number of different battery types. We were wondering, with respect to the process outside of the technology, more so on the business model, customers and suppliers, could you give us a sense of who some of the key suppliers and the key customers would be for your products?
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, Li-Cycle does take all types of lithium-ion batteries. I'm going to talk about this on the in and the out. So what comes to us and then where we sell to. So yeah, so imagine everything, right? Cell phone batteries, home appliance batteries, to batteries from EVs, from hybrids, to, you know, passenger vehicles, to battery manufacturing scrap. Right? Anytime a new battery is made in any facility, there's a level of waste and rejects and scrap. So it's a very broad net. I mean, I think the craziest thing I've seen is probably like the size of a bus battery, right? Like getting to that. And then we're already talking about marine. So this is a big gamut of material. So to your question, you know, who are the customers? The customers fall along all those verticals. So we work B2B. If I were to split up our supply really simply, you could think of it as small format and large format. Small format are, you know, consumer device batteries and similar, laptop cell phones. The groups that we typically get those from, they run a collection program where you go to Best Buy or Home Depot, they have the collection boxes or an office building. They run those programs. They then sort, aggregate, isolate lithium ion, and that's what we get from that. So that today is about 50% of our supply. And then a large format, I'm just going to bucket this across many categories. That's passenger EVs, larger size, even I'd group in there manufacturing scrap as well. So that is direct B2B with the auto manufacturers, with the battery manufacturers. And what I'll say there, and this does link to, I'll get to the end product side, it does link to the growth. We can unpack this further as needed, but, you know, initially, manufacturing scrap, you know, there's 192 of these battery mega factories in the pipeline in the world. This is to help meet all this demand for batteries. Every one of them, you know, generates some level of waste, could be 5 to 10% of their output. So that is growing in lockstep with the proliferation of lithium-ion batteries and EVs. And for our supply chain, what we see from our existing customer network, that is the part which is scaling the most rapidly now and into the medium term. And then that's before the long term, which everyone can conceptualize, this tsunami of batteries, right, that's coming. Okay, that's there, but that's a bit of a ways away. For now, our industry really heavily being driven by this manufacturing scrap portion, and we have a good diversity of different types of batteries. So that's on the end. Last comment set around the out, and then I'll pause. The materials that we make, so we make lithium, nickel, cobalt chemicals ultimately out of the hub. So broadly speaking, those materials go back to the battery supply chain. So we eventually go back to a cathode manufacturer or a group that supplies a cathode manufacturer, which then goes into a cell, which then goes back into a pack or whatever the application is. So that's the pathway back for the material. That actually hasn't really been done before. A lot of these materials have been ending up back in metal and then maybe back into alloys. So this is now the first time we're really closing the supply chain loop. And we have an off-taker for those materials named Traxys. They're the largest independent nickel cobalt trader globally. In short, we work with them because it's a physical off-take trading partner. One channel for all the downstreams from them back to batteries. We have off-take with them through to 2030. That's to buy 100% of the materials from the hub in New York, in Rochester. So I'll pause there. Really, that helps to elucidate. We've structurized the ins, structurized the outs. And that's another core part of our moat and all the work we've done in the past years.
So in terms of the geographical presence, I know post-transaction, you plan a global expansion. But what's interesting about this is you're a Canadian company based out of Ontario, spoke one in Kingston, spoke two in Rochester, but you're choosing to have hub one in Rochester, New York. How did that geographical segmentation work? Like, how did you end up with that result?
Yeah, and I'll start maybe from the end answer, then I'll get to where we ended up there. So we eventually want to build 20 spokes around the world, base case, two operating today, as you pointed out, and four hubs. So the whole point here is basically regionalize our presence. You can say on a continent by continent basis or region by region basis. That's eventually where we're going. Now, working back from that to where we are today, yeah, Kingston, from a Canada perspective, very centrally located from a logistics standpoint. Rochester, we went to for the second spoke. There's a lot of electronic waste processing in the Northeast. We have a lot of customer base that's actually in that channel there on the Eastern Seaboard. So that was a good facility, you know, for the second facility. And now our third that we'll be building in North America is going to be on the West Coast. So we're actually in progress with that. That's the third spoke in North America. And that's going to help address California and a lot of the EV penetration there. So the spokes continue to build. It's not the end. For the hub, to your question, why do we end up there? Yeah, look, it's the old Kodak Business Park. Tons of great chemical infrastructure, labor, strong incentives, very strong support from the state of New York. We're very fortunate for that. So what it did for us, why we chose that site, and this is different for the hubs, we want centralized processing and we don't want to spend a lot of money on infrastructure. So if we can plug into existing power, you know, steam, whatever it is that we need, that's a big benefit because now we're not spending CapEx dollars on something which we don't need to be, right? And so that was a reason why that came out on the top. And we looked at a variety of sites for that hub facility before making that decision.
Makes sense. Appears to be very strategic in terms of the placement of these various hubs and spokes. But let's get into the exciting news. Recently announced going public transaction with SPAC Peridot Acquisition. We're always interested in learning the background happenings with respect to how these deals come together. You guys are somewhat unique. Not a lot of Canadian companies going public via US listed SPAC. So how did this come to fruition? Was it inbound? Was it an outbound thing that you guys were looking to utilize to further accelerate your growth?
Yeah, and I get a lot of inbounds asking from other entrepreneurs. This is helpful maybe to put out on a podcast.
No doubt.
So look, in our case, there was an outbound process. And it starts with, you know, the business objectives. You know, as I laid out there, we split up the spoke in the hub, building this hub in Rochester, made that announcement last year, actually. So we have a CapEx spend and a use of proceeds that we need. And so we, before that, before making the decision to go down the SPAC path, we looked at a variety of options, everything from private equity through to other types of financing in the metals world, whole range. And, you know, I think those are still optionality where it's not much exclusive, you know, for the company. But the thing that we wanted was efficiency to fully fund the business plan. And, you know, we have, you know, now, you know, over 100 people, we have 40 plus people working on the hub project. So we're hurtling down that track and we have global plans. So when we were looking at that pros, cons, efficiency, fully funding the business, really struck us that this was a good path. Then it led to, we work with Citi as our main advisor. We also work with Cowen. And, we went through a very rigorous, you know, multi-stage look at what we need, you know, looking at a variety of potential partners from the SPAC side. We chose the Peridot folks because what we wanted was a partner that actually adds value, both from a capital markets perspective, but now, you know, they're going to be on our board. And so we wanted folks that would actually, you know, have some industry expertise, scaling. We're in a very heavy scaling mode, people, talent acquisition, corporate governance from a PubCo perspective, right? So these are all things we were looking for. And we ended up selecting Peridot mutually. And and yeah, very excited about it. But I can say now, you know, retrospect through this process, there's a ton of touch points and there's a lot of work to get through the de-SPAC and then beyond you're listed. And that's, I think, the important foundational way to go at it. I do hear a lot of entrepreneurs getting a lot of inbounds and other things happening. And just our two cents, we would hope that it happens the other way typically. But anyways, to each their own.
Yeah, exactly. And so going through this process and having a number of entrepreneurs reach out looking for advice, what are some tips and tricks and, you know, recommendations with respect to if they have a business of a certain size and certain capital needs and really looking to take it to the next level? Would you recommend a SPAC? And if so, what are some tips and tricks that you've learned throughout the process thus far?
Yeah, I think it starts, we had a lot of long conversations with our board. I mean, I think it starts with identifying, you know, the business objectives, use of proceeds, what's the full gamut of opportunities, the ways that you could fulfill the business plan, and starting there, right? And obviously a SPAC and a potential PIPE raise with it is one route, but there's many. And so I think that's really important. We spend a lot of time, you know, assessing pros and cons with our board. I think then after that's been thought through judiciously, and if there is a decision to go down this path and it seemed to be pros and cons weighted, you know, the right path, I think tips and tricks for folks that want to do it. You know, one, I think what was important and what we did was really spend the time to find a good bank and a good advisor to really help lead the process with us. It's a ton of work in a pretty short period of time. And you want folks that have done it before, you know, have a little bit of an understanding of the landscape. The market is obviously, you know, changing all the time, you know, can help with material prep, you know, for actually going out and running such a process. So there's a ton of support, right, you get from a bank. And so we went through a process even before we selected Citi of looking at many, and we ended up selecting them based on, you know, experience and SPAC experience, sector experience. We also knew the team for a while. So that's why we did that. And then what I'd say outside of that is just run a structured process. I think that's the best thing one can do, because, you know, it can be very frenetic, and M&A and deal making tends to be. There's that nature of it. But I think sticking from the objective-led lens is going to lead down to a path that has a good foundation and then be a good foundation for the success thereafter. And I think if any of those things are not done right to the opposite, then of course you can run into issues.
Now, with respect to working with Citi, obviously very reputable, very well known, and I'm sure they played a key role in the $315 million PIPE financing, which was actually upsized as well. So great job behind that. Could you give us some details on how that came together, the process behind that? You certainly got some good investors, Neuberger, Franklin Templeton, Mubadala Capital. How did that all come together, and what role did you play within the raising of the PIPE financing?
Yeah, in all these things, preparation is key, right? So we spent with Peridot, you know, a couple months net before, you know, they had their diligence to do before we even launched, you know, the PIPE, and ton of, you know, work on materials and you know, assessing, you know, how things are positioned in terms of telling the story and trying to keep distilling things down. So a ton of work behind that. And then, yeah, we had three main banks involved, two from the Peridot side, so Citi, UBS, and Barclays, from the latter two from the Peridot side. So they were the three PIPE placing agents. You know, again, the market keeps changing, but, you know, as we went through this process, it was only a few weeks. And we met with a good number of investors. The nice thing these days, you know, as a potential pro vis-a-vis COVID, purely virtual, very efficient.
Right? Yeah, I bet.
You know, meet folks from many, many different cities, which usually would be pretty tough on a usual roadshow to do that efficiently. So yeah, and the role we played, you know, I had my co-founder Tim and I and our CFO Bruce, and we're on every call. But yeah, I would say, you know, telling the story and really helping lead the discussion. But, you know, I'd say support behind that was, you know, strong group of banks and the Peridot folks, you know, with us on each of those calls. And now even through the post-deal or post-announcement phase, has been really good. Because again, I think back to the tips and tricks, I think you want a partner. That's really the key thing. You want a partner that's going to be there with you, understands the story, done the diligence, can speak credibly to them as an independent in some ways that's now joined forces with the company.
And now a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest growing alternative investment solution providers. With a suite of institutional caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance, the Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF, symbol 1C. ONEC on the TSX is Canada's first alternatives portfolio solution, providing exposure to 6 alternative asset classes, 10 alternative strategies in one easy-to-use, one-choice ETF that charges a management fee of just 0.2%. The Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF trades under the symbol 1C ONEC on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
So once you close the business combination, assuming that, Peridot trades similar to where it's at a premium to NAV, you're looking at having, you know, potentially over $500 million of cash on the balance sheet after post deal close. Can you just go over a little bit of your additional plans? You've spoken to the spokes and hubs that you're looking to plan in the future. But in addition to that, like any potential M&A, whether it be horizontal M&A or vertical, potential uses for some of that as the company moves forward.
Yeah, and great question. I'll bucket the uses into 4, and it does segment between North America and then global. So I'll start with North America. As I mentioned, you know, the whole reason we went down this path was to really help fully fund, in particular, the hub in Rochester. And for our financials, you know, we have the supply base that's basically predicated our growth in that direction. We have the offtake through to 2030. So that's a core focus of execution. And this now fully funds that. The CapEx for the plant in Rochester is $172 million. Part of the boost proceeds, it's an important one. And this basically helps see that through fully. So that's point one. And then, you know, ex North America, again, big picture, we're looking at 20 total spokes, 4 hubs. We have a plan between Europe, China, APAC. We spent these past years, again, alongside boots on the ground. We have board members that are also based, you know, in Hong Kong, you know, also work heavily in China. That, you know, we are going in this direction, you know, from a global growth standpoint, and we're executing it 3 ways. One is regional partnerships or joint ventures. So, you know, this market is highly variable by region, and there are nuances. You want access to speed, essentially, where maybe a partner has batteries, they need to be recycled, human capital, facilities, permits. So we have a variety of progress stage negotiations on that front, and this will come out of the next year and beyond, that sits behind the rollout plan and part of the use of proceeds where we have capital to be allocated, say in a JV, will be in that direction, you know, point one. Point two, from our organic growth standpoint, you know, it's interesting, as we were leading up even to the transaction, I'd say increasingly we were getting asked by customers, just on the global side even, you know, hey, you're serving us here. We have the same need over here in a different region. Can you help us? And so that's happening more and more. And that leads organic growth. And that'll be another way that we're using the proceeds and fulfilling the 20 spokes and 4 hubs. And then lastly, to your point about buy-side M&A or any transaction of that nature, yeah, and this is explicit in our investor presentation that's public. We do see opportunities when we've been working in these regions, be it Europe, be it APAC, that there are sometimes, you know, groups that have supply potentially, or they're a regional player and they have permits and, you know, but maybe what they lack is the technology. So that's an opportunity for us, again, to bolt on what we're doing, what we get is speed, and also the human capital, right? The team, that's a big focus of ours right now in terms of continuing to scale. Yeah, so I'll pause there. Across all those, the North American plan, the 3-pronged approach for the global plans, this helps to fully fund that full rollout along those strategy lines.
Now, once this SPAC merger is complete, you'll be up and running as a fully public company. And Lysicle has a unique story. I'm just looking at the investor presentation. It doesn't really have any direct comparables in the market. I'm looking that you compare to electrification facilitators, battery EVs, battery manufacturers, waste management, lithium producers. So all sorts of different types of companies. But for investors new to the Lysicle story, could you provide a quick elevator pitch for why they should be shareholders of your company?
Yeah, and I'll start maybe with where we sit, and then I'll talk about what we do. First, look, Lysicle sits at the epicenter of 3 key megatrends. Electric vehicles, lithium-ion batteries being ubiquitous in our lives as part of that. Second, ESG and circular economy. And third, the critical material supply, lithium, nickel, cobalt, from domestic sources that is needed to make this whole supply chain grow. So from the comp perspective, as you just touched on, Julian, that's, we sit at the epicenter of all those themes. Now, Lifecycle, we are the fit for purpose solution, the most sustainable, meaning both economically sustainable and environmentally sustainable solution for the recycling of all types of lithium ion batteries. We're doing it today. We have proven technology. We're real business, 40 plus battery supply customers. We have offtake and we're really in scaling mode. And we've had the benefit of being early in this space and locking up IP and really getting going here to secure a moat. But this is the first inning. And this industry needs to grow in lockstep with electrification and lithium ion batteries. And this is an opportunity to enter at the ground floor.
It's certainly an intriguing story, exciting times for you guys. I'd like to thank you for being on the podcast today. Definitely clarified the story. Really interesting to get the insight into how it developed, the background on the SPAC business combination, and the future growth plans for the company. So wrapping things up, where can investors find out more about Lifecycle and what you guys are all about?
Yeah, so they can visit our webpage, li-cycle.com. There's an investor page that has the announcement around the transaction, investor presentation that we keep up to date, as well as other details. And stay tuned. There's a variety of pieces of news that will be coming. It's consistent news flow in the next little bit. And you can keep out an eye on that on the website front, as well as, I'd say, Twitter. Our team is super active on that front, as well as LinkedIn. So thanks very much.
Yeah, there you have it, folks. Definitely do the due diligence on the company if you're interested in perhaps investing. Go to the website, follow them on social media. I'd like to thank you for your time today, Ajay. Super excited. We'll be cheering for you on the sidelines as shareholders in the entity, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Cheers. All right. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.